dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
Tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Idaho, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Over the preceding 3 weeks, we aired a documentary series, The Power of Nightmares, that chronicled the efforts of the neoconservatives to combat what they called selfish individualism, which they believed was destroying the social order. To combat this selfish individualism, government, they said, must create inspiring myths for mass consumption, such as the noble mission of the United States to battle evil in the world. George Bush's inauguration speech could have been a textbook example of this. He announced that the U.S. would, as usual, devote itself to the promotion of freedom and democracy in the world. He did not define what he meant by freedom and democracy, but we will. This week on the program, we're going to see how consistent U.S. policy toward the world has been. Beneath the stylistic differences of Republicans or Democrats, neocons or liberals, the aim has always been freedom and democracy, as those terms are defined by the corporate and government elites who make the policies. We will devote the entire program to a speech given almost 20 years ago by Professor Noam Chomsky, where he defines the real meaning of these terms. This speech, which was given during the Reagan-Bush administration, will explain the method behind the madness, as well as provide some insight as to why the Democratic Party, except for a handful of dissenters, will not stand up against widespread voter disenfranchisement and election rigging. Now, Professor Noam Chomsky speaking in 1986.
The printed title for this talk is U.S. International and Security Policy, the Right Turn in Historical Perspective. You'll notice that the phrase right turn was in quotes. The reason for that is not because the phenomenon is unreal, of course it is real, but rather because it is not, in my view, what it is often thought to be. What I want to discuss is what the right turn really is and how it fits into deeper and much more enduring characteristics of American policy and state policy and society. I'm largely going to restrict attention to international policy here with a few words on security policy towards the end if there's time, but let me stress that this is obviously just a piece of a much larger story which includes domestic issues as well that ought to be brought in. And in the question period, we can, you know, have a free-for-all and go into anything. Well, to begin with, what's the right turn? This is associated conventionally with the Reagan administration, and in that regard, I want to make two comments. First of all, I will refer to Reagan, but when I'm referring to Reagan, I want it to be understood that I do not mean the individual Ronald Reagan, who is, in fact, largely a creation of the public relations industry, and who literally often does not know and is not expected to know what policies are or what the words on the cue cards mean. That's an interesting fact. It's an interesting fact about American politics, but when I use the term Reagan, I'm not referring to that individual. Rather, I'm referring to the elite groups for whom he serves as a spokesman, or more important, as a device to ensure public acquiescence, or at least public passivity with regard to the policies of the groups who have created him as an image to appear before the public. Second point is that these elite groups constitute one rather extremist segment of a much broader elite consensus. And that is why there's no serious challenge to Reaganite policies within the mainstream, apart from tactical disagreement now and then. We see this on particular occasions. For example, the terrorist bombing of Libya, which is the most serious terrorist act of this year in terms of its scale. The terrorist bombing of Libya in April, at that point, Reagan's sharpest critics, if you look back, people like Anthony Lewis and his congressional critics, they immediately flocked to the jingoist consensus. And more generally, we see this in the way that congressional liberals joined in dismantling the welfare state measures under pursuing what's called a Reaganite program. This was allegedly in response to a public mood which demonstrably does not exist. In fact, the major Reaganite programs, including dismantling of welfare state measures, military buildup, and so on, these were actually initiated under the Carter administration and simply continued, in some cases, escalated under Reagan. The same is true of the U.S. war in El Salvador and much else. So the point is that the right turn is actually much broader than is commonly assumed, and it's furthermore an elite phenomenon. That's important. It's important to bear in mind that the public has been strongly opposed to the major policies of the Reagan administration. This is a fact that is totally irrelevant as long as the public is passive and acquiescent, but it is a demonstrable fact and well known to public opinion analysts. Nevertheless, the right turn is somehow associated with or crystallized in the Reaganite programs. So let's begin to have a look at those. What are the Reaganite programs which supposedly constitute the right turn? Well, they basically fall into three related categories. First, there are the programs which have involved a rather substantial transfer of resources from the poor to the rich. Second program is a large increase in intervention, subversion, international terrorism, and general gangsterism and lawlessness. Third, there has been a huge increase in the state sector of the economy, this in the traditional American way, through the military system. The military system serves as a state-guaranteed market for high-technology waste production, with armaments, in other words. Or from another point of view, it serves as a device, as a means of state industrial management, a means of forced public subsidy for the most advanced sectors of high-technology industry. In fact, the ratio of state expenditures to gross national product has risen more rapidly under Reagan than at any time since the Second World War, and this fanatic Keynesianism of the Reagan administration has had the predictable consequences, such as the huge deficit. This vast increase in the intervention of the state in the economic system under Reagan has also coincided with other measures taken to strengthen the state relative to the citizenry, measures to protect the state from public scrutiny, to block public discussion, attacks on civil liberties, and so on. These are the three, as I see it, the three major components of the Reagan program: transfer of resources from the poor to the rich, interventionism, lawlessness, gangsterism, and so on, and a huge increase in the power of the state, strengthening the power of the state and its intervention in the economy, its role in state industrial management and in organizing a public subsidy for high technology industry. If you think about these measures, and they are the Reaganite measures, it's clear that the so-called right turn is not a turn towards conservatism, quite the contrary. There happen to be very few conservatives in American politics or in American society. There are few. Mark Hatfield might qualify in the Senate. I'm another one, incidentally, in essential respects, but there are very few of us. And old-fashioned conservatives, like Robert Taft, for example, would turn over in their graves at the way the term is now being used. It is now being used to refer to fanatic Keynesianism, to lawlessness, and to extreme advocacy of welfare state measures, although now a welfare state for the rich, not the poor, as state policy is reshaped even more than it usually is to benefit the privileged and to serve their needs. So this is nothing like conservatism. Now, in this connection, let me make a general observation, which I think is worth bearing in mind. In political discourse, most terms are used with a kind of a technical meaning, which is divorced from and often the exact opposite of their ordinary meaning. Conservatism is a case in point, but there are many other examples. So take, for example, the term democracy. The way that's used in political discourse in the United States is to, and in other countries too, is to refer to a system of elite decision with occasional ratification on the part of an irrelevant public. If segments of the usually irrelevant and apathetic public begin to organize and to try to participate in some meaningful fashion in shaping affairs of state, that is not democracy. That is called a crisis of democracy, as liberal elites in fact call it, and it's a crisis that has to be overcome by various means. In El Salvador, you overcome it by death squads. At home, you overcome it by more subtle devices. Or take the term free enterprise, which is used to refer to a system of public subsidy and private profit, which is organized by massive state intervention in the economy, as under the Reagan administration. Or take the term defense against aggression, which is used naturally for aggression, as, for example, when the United States attacked South Vietnam 25 years ago, in 1962. This was referred to as defense against aggression. In fact, it was called defense against internal aggression by the liberal hero Adlai Stevenson, who explained that, in fact, this was what was happening there was aggression by South Vietnamese against the U.S. Air Force in South Vietnam. The U.S. Air Force at that time was bombing them out of their homes and into concentration camps. We had to defend them against internal aggression. These, incidentally, are not my terms. They're their terms throughout. Or take, finally, the term national interest, which is an interesting case. The national interest, the term national interest, is used in political science and so on to refer to the special interest of privileged elites. The national interest often happens to refer to something very costly to the general population. And since the national interest refers to the special interest of privileged elites, naturally, the term special interest has to have a comparable interpretation. It has to refer to the population, and it does. If you look at political discourse, you'll notice that national interest refers to the special interest of privileged groups, and special interest refers to the population at large. This became very clear in the 1980 and 1984 elections. One of the interesting features of the group around Reagan is their extraordinary command of public relations. That's basically, you know, that there's a strong component of the public relations industry there, and they do their job well. You remember that the campaign rhetoric accused the Democrats of being the party of the special interests. You all recall that. Now, if you look at who they referred to in the campaign rhetoric, you look through it, you'll notice that the special interests were women, blacks, youth, elderly, handicapped, in short, the population. They were the special interests. Only one group didn't qualify as special interests, corporations. And that's right, because they're the national interest. Now, in fact, the claim that the Democrats represent the special interests, that is, the population, is totally false. They also represent the national interest. But what's interesting is the way the elite groups on both sides accept this usage, accept the usage that the population are the special interests and the corporations are the national interest. Well, we could go on, but term by term, that's the way it works. In order to understand political discourse, you have to bear this in mind and carry out a regular translation procedure of the technical vocabulary. The technical vocabulary is used in the media and the academic social sciences and elsewhere to ensure that nothing will be understood about how the society is working and what is happening in the world. And that's, of course, important to preserve democracy, namely a system in which the public doesn't participate. Let me summarize so far. The right turn is an elite phenomenon. It's not a turn towards conservatism, but rather a turn towards a kind of reactionary jingoism, which is quite the opposite of conservatism. Furthermore, the policies are highly unpopular. This is a very heavily polled society because business wants to keep its finger on the public pulse, and we have extensive poll results which indicate that from the beginning of the Reagan Revolution, the public has been strongly opposed to every major program. So on, say, social spending versus military spending, the public favors cuts in military spending over social spending by ratios like 4-1 or 7-1, depending on the program. On contra aid, the public opposes it by 2-1, and so on, policy by policy. The policies are, in fact, unpopular, and it's not hard to understand why. The public in general is not going to be in favor of policies that turn the state into a welfare state for the rich, and that organize a public subsidy for high technology industry, nor are they in favor of interventionism and aggression and so on. Now, the fact that the policies are unpopular causes certain problems, naturally. And there's a classic answer to these problems, an answer which is used in democratic societies or totalitarian societies, where you also have to gain popular support for policy, in fact. And there's a classic answer to this kind of problem. You frighten the population. You threaten them with a great Satan, with an evil empire that's going to destroy them. And then maybe they'll accept the policies as an unfortunate necessity in the face of this threat. However, that also has problems. If you enter into confrontations with the evil empire, it could be dangerous because they can fight back. So what it's necessary to do is to enter into confrontations with the evil empire's proxies. You find groups around the world that are essentially defenseless, where you can murder them at will and they can't fight back, and you make them the proxies of the evil empire, and then you can attack them. And those confrontations can be used to terrify the domestic population and to ram through unpopular policies. And that's the way it works. If you want, I'll elaborate later. But the fact of the matter is that, for example, Libya has been selected by the Reagan administration public relations people as a perfect target. Defenseless, weak, tiny, kill Libyans at will and nobody cares, given the background of anti-Arab racism. And you can designate them a proxy of the evil empire. And in fact, the Reagan administration has set up regular planned confrontations with the Libyans to try to evoke jingoist hysteria at home and to reinforce the jingoist consensus so that it's possible to pursue these unpopular policies. They've been helped in this by a very effective disinformation apparatus known as the media. And in fact, this is sort of off my topic, so I won't go into it, but there are very interesting things to say about that. If you want later, I'll go into it. Anyhow, that's the way you sell the policy. Terrify the population, but not with confrontations with the evil empire, which is far too dangerous, rather with its designated proxies who are safe because you can attack them at will. The current right turn began in the early 1970s. This was in large part a response to the Vietnam War, which created a number of problems, basically two categories of problems for the elite groups that run the American state and private society. It's a tightly related nexus. One class of problems was economic. The fact of the matter was that the Vietnam War ended up being quite costly to the United States, and it also ended up being quite profitable to our major enemies, that is, our industrial rivals in the First World, the industrial capitalist societies. So it was very profitable for Japan, for example. Just like the Korean War was, the Korean War too was extremely profitable for Japan, and in fact the Korean War and the Vietnam War, where Japan could serve as a source for production and procurement and so on for the American war, that's what created the Japanese economic miracle. It's worth remembering that under the Kennedy administration in the early 1960s, Japan was, it's hard to remember this, but the Kennedy administration was concerned about trying to find measures that would make the Japanese economy viable. That's not the problem today, exactly. And that change took place crucially during the Vietnam War. In fact, the U.S. trade patterns with Japan shifted in 1965, prior to that, we always had a favorable balance of trade with Japan. After that, with marginal exceptions, it's always been negative, increasingly so. What happened was that the costs of the war to our economy translated into gains for the economies of our enemies, Japan, Canada, Western Europe, and so on. That created a serious economic crisis. It meant that U.S. domination of the industrial world was beginning to erode. Now, a number of steps were taken in response to this particular problem. One major step was an attack on labor, drive down wages, an attack on social programs to transfer resources towards the wealthy, towards the investors, and so on. All of this was in the interest of restoring profits and restoring the power of American business quite generally. And of course, that reflects an elite consensus. There's no central dispute over those matters within the sectors that provide planners and policymakers. So that's one class of problems, which leads straight to Reaganism. The second class of problems fall roughly under the category of discipline, and that has to do in part with the Third World. Again, partly because of the Vietnam War, but partly for other reasons, there was a lot of growing lack of discipline in the Third World. With the breakup of the Portuguese Empire, there were very dangerous steps towards independence in its various components. There was ferment in Central America. There was a real threat that democracy might develop there. I'll come back to that. And all of these things had to be repressed. The lack of discipline in the Third World had to be stopped, and they had to be returned to what the Washington Post calls in Central America the Central American mode, meaning terror and torture states and so on. And this requires intervention, and intervention requires a jingoist consensus. And that brings us to the second problem of discipline, which is domestic. The population was out of control, dramatically so. The Vietnam War contributed to the politicization of American society. That is, it led to a crisis of democracy. In fact, Crisis of Democracy was the name of the very interesting book written by the Trilateral Commission, their one major publication. And remember that that's a grouping of liberal elites. It's the group around Carter, basically. And in this publication, which is very much worth reading carefully, it's in 1975, they describe the crisis of democracy. What happened in the 60s, in part because of the Vietnam War and so on, was that segments of the normally apathetic population became organized for political action and tried to enter the political arena. And that, of course, is intolerable, so that has to be stopped, and you got to figure out a way to reduce the public to their traditional apathy and passivity, and it's necessary to overcome the what they call the excesses of the press, which barely existed, but they were frightening, those tiny deviations from obedience, and it is necessary to control what they called the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young, meaning the universities and the schools and so on. And in general, it was necessary to overcome what is called the Vietnam Syndrome. The Vietnam Syndrome, that's a term, it's an interesting term. Syndrome is a disease of some kind. And this refers to the disease that large parts of the population, in fact, a large majority of the population, began to gain some insight into the way the world is working, expressed opposition to aggression and massacre and torture, and a degree of solidarity with their victims. And that's, of course, totally intolerable, just as the crisis of democracy is. And all of that had to be overcome and to restore a jingoist consensus in support of interventionist policies. These are the factors that lie behind the right turn. And because these concerns are shared across liberal and so-called conservative, liberal and jingoist reactionary elites, there being no conservatives to speak of, there is essentially no opposition to the policies. So the right turn then exists, and it had a number of contributory factors, and it has been proceeding through the 1970s and into the 80s with the cooperation of virtually all elite groups, and they are concerned over the threat posed by several major enemies, the first enemy being the industrial rivals of the United States, Japan, England, not so much England anymore, but Germany, Japan, even now South Korea, and so on. Second enemy, third world upstarts who are refusing to follow orders. and have dangerous ideas about independence. And thirdly, the domestic population, which is always a major enemy, unless it is sufficiently apathetic and controlled. Now, of course, all of this has to be concealed, and it is. It's framed in the conventional Cold War demonology of superpower confrontation. But the fact of the matter is that the Soviet-American conflict, though it's quite real, is only a secondary factor in these developments. I'll come back to it. It's placed in the forefront for the reasons I mentioned in order to frighten the population into obedience. And it would be very hard, for example, to convince Americans that, say, Nicaragua or peasants in El Salvador or Libya or the PLO constitute a threat to their existence. But if they are all proxies of the evil empire, which is spreading its tentacles and threatening to destroy us, then the threat becomes more credible and the population can be mobilized to accept such programs as those of the later Carter and Reagan administration, accept them as an unfortunate necessity to save us from destruction. That's basically the way the ideological system works. Well, if we look, I'm going to come back to this again, but now let's take a quick look back to earlier history, and we'll find that this combination is not at all novel. In fact, it's repeatedly happened over and over, and it's worth looking at that to understand it. There have been other so-called right turns. In fact, we find that every major war of this century has evoked a similar reaction on the part of elite groups, that is, business, the political elites that are primarily business-based, the corporate media, and the privileged intelligentsia generally, who serve as the ideological managers or the commissars, as we might call them. After every one of these major wars, there has been a similar campaign on the part of these groups, a similar right turn. So during World War I, during and after World War I, the Wilson administration, which was called a progressive administration, under the pretext of a Bolshevik threat, launched a Red Scare that succeeded very effectively in deterring the threat of democracy in the true sense, while reinforcing democracy in the technical Orwellian sense. It succeeded in undermining the labor movement, undermining dissident politics, and reinforcing corporate power. There were several lasting institutional effects of the Red Scare, which was quite serious and accepted by a broad elite consensus, including the liberals, who were passionately opposed to freedom of expression and to organizing, and said so quite openly. Two permanent effects of that, institutional effects, were the rise of the public relations industry, which is almost a unique American phenomenon, reflecting the very high level of class consciousness on the part of American business elites. The rest of the world is way behind them in that respect. And a second institutional result was the National Political Police, what's called the FBI, which is primarily concerned with suppressing democracy, with suppressing political dissent, organization, activism, and often is commissioned to use violence to do this, as it was by the Kennedy administration and many others. Those two institutions grew out of the effective Red Scare, which did succeed in destroying potentially democratic organizations like, say, labor unions and others, and at least very seriously weakening them and restoring corporate power. It was also, incidentally, at this time that liberal democratic theorists, people like Walter Lippmann, well-known liberal journalist, it's at that time that they began to emphasize what they called, Lippmann in this case, called the manufacture of consent, or the engineering of democratic consent. That is, it's at that time that the explicit theory was developed by elites, and it's worth knowing that it was explicit, the theory that said that in a society, in a country where the state does not have the resources to control the population by violence, it's necessary to resort to thought control. In other words, if the voice of the people is heard, you have to make sure that that voice says the right thing. And that requires manufacture of consent, it requires propaganda, it requires indoctrination, it requires public relations, and so on. All of this was developed quite explicitly beginning with the 1920s, and in fact it's a major theme not only of the public relations industry, but also of academic social science and what's called democratic theory in the Orwellian sense ever since then. I mean, it's not that that began at that time, but all of this became institutionalized at the time of the Red Scare on the basis, using the pretext of a fabricated Bolshevik threat in the around the end of the First World War and shortly after, in an effort which was successful to avert the crisis of democracy then. Well, the Second World War led to similar developments, the most familiar aspect being the phenomenon that's mislabeled McCarthyism. In fact, it was a broad-based effort spearheaded at first by liberal Democrats with a strong support of the by then very well-organized public relations industry. The point was to overcome the crisis of democracy that was then brewing during and after the Second World War. And again, it was quite conscious. It was conscious through the latter period of the Depression and later. In 1938, the National Association of Manufacturers Board of Directors concluded, I'm now quoting, concluded that the hazard facing industrialists is the newly realized political power of the masses. Unless their thinking is directed, they said, we are definitely headed for adversity. Notice, incidentally, that business groups, when they're talking to one another, quite often use vulgar Marxist rhetoric like this. That's not uncommon. And in fact, substantial efforts were taken by the highly class-conscious business groups to overcome the threat, namely the newly realized political power of the masses, which was, again, a crisis of democracy. And it had considerable success, and it was recognized internally. So in 1947, the State Department Public Relations Officer, Melton Davis, commented, and again I'm quoting, that smart public relations has paid off as it has before and will again, and it has moved the public opinion climate sharply to the right, anti-social change, anti-economic change, anti-labor, at the same time that the rest of the world, including Europe, was moving in the opposite direction, admitting labor into the government and passing liberalized legislation. So that's, again, a successful propaganda effort, including the whole elite apparatus, including the commissars, business, public relations, and so on, to turn the country to the right and to avert the threat of democracy. In some of these developments in the rest of the world, just referred to, caused quite a lot of concern, and U.S. power was applied to halt them. I'll return to that in a moment. But now I'm talking about the primary enemy, namely the domestic population. Well, the point of these comments is that wars and other periods of turmoil, like depressions, they tend to involve people in social and political action. They tend to create a crisis of democracy, a threat of political organization and engagement on the part of the population. That is a threat that there might be moves towards meaningful democracy. And naturally, dominant elites have to rally to prevent this threat to privilege and power. So we get the Red Scare during and after World War I, the post-World War II repression and PR campaign, which was quite serious, and the right turn of the post-Vietnam decade, which we're now in the midst of. In all three cases, one major enemy was the domestic population, that is, the special interests, as they're called in contemporary newspeak. They have to be returned to apathy and passivity. In all three cases, the Bolshevik threat was used quite effectively for this purpose. Before the Bolsheviks were around, it was necessary to appeal to other threats to accomplish similar purposes. So when Wilson invaded the Dominican Republic in Haiti in 1915 and 16, there were no Bolsheviks around, so we were defending ourselves against the Huns at that time. And throughout our earlier history, we were defending ourselves against Great Britain, as we slaughtered the native population and conquered the national territory, a major theme of U.S. history, incidentally, from the earliest days. Now, other powers, of course, use similar devices. It wasn't invented by the United States, though it has been perfected, not surprisingly, given the greater need for effective indoctrination in a society where the state does not have the resources to coerce the citizenry by violence, exactly as liberal theorists in the public relations industry have emphasized. But other powers use similar devices. So take the Soviet Union, opposite extreme from us, totalitarian dungeon, lots of resources of violence to control the population. Nevertheless, the population has to more or less at least be passive, if not acquiescent in policy. That's always a necessity, and they are. So they don't have public opinion polls, but as far as can be judged, the policy of the population of the Soviet Union does support what they call the defense of Hungary, or the defense of Czechoslovakia, or the defense of Afghanistan. They see themselves as acting in defense of those countries, ultimately in self-defense against the evil empire, which is intent on their destruction, namely the United States. The Cold War, in fact, is highly functional for dominant elites in both of the superpowers, which have a kind of a system of tacit cooperation. Each has to fight against its primary enemy, namely special interests in its own country, its own population. And one of the ways they do it is by terrifying them with the crimes, which are quite real in both cases, of the evil empire. This functional utility of the Cold War is incidentally one reason why it persists, despite the long-term threat that it poses to survival. Well, I've talked so far about how the groups that control the economy and the state and the ideological institutions react to threats to their power and privilege, the threats raised by one primary enemy, namely the domestic population, the special interests. But there are, of course, other enemies that have to be confronted. The industrial powers of the First World, Europe, Japan, and so on, and their populations, and as I mentioned, they were getting out of control after the Second World War, the peoples of the Third World, and the Soviet Union. So how were these challenges addressed by American planners? Well, let me concentrate now on the post-World War II situation. In fact, let's begin with World War II. World War II, in fact, instituted a new world order. Not totally new, but new in significant respects. It was new primarily in that there was one power, one state with overwhelming power, namely the United States. At the end of World War II, the United States had a degree of wealth and power relative to others that has no historical parallel to it, as far as I know. The United States literally had about half of the world's wealth. During World War II, most of our industrial rivals were either severely weakened or totally destroyed, while the World War was very beneficial to the United States. Our territory, of course, was never under attack, the national territory, and in fact, American industrial production quadrupled or tripled or quadrupled, depending on which measure you pick, during the Second World War. And in fact, long before the Second World War, we already had been the greatest industrial power in the world. Furthermore, there were no enemies. The United States had no enemies in the hemisphere. It controlled both oceans. It controlled most of the opposite sides of both oceans. In fact, if you think there has never been a period in history when one power had such overwhelming control of the world's wealth or such overwhelming security, that naturally created a new situation. Well, American planners understood it. They understood all of that, and they were determined to keep things that way. There was a spectrum of opinion. This, incidentally, is a very open society by comparative standards. We have a rich documentary record. You have to work to find it because it's excluded from the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young, as the liberal ideologists call them. But it's there. You know, it's there if you forget the history books and the political science texts and so on, and you go back to the documentary record, you find a lot of riches. And the picture looks approximately like this. There was an elite consensus that the dominance of the United States had to be maintained, but there was a spectrum of opinion as to how to do it, roughly hawks and doves. At the hardline extreme, you have documents such as the National Security Council Memorandum 68. These are all top secret documents, but they've been released, 30 years later and so on, so they're now available. NSC 68 in 1950, written by Paul Nitze, who's still around, he's one of Reagan's negotiators now, that's the hardline extreme. This it's important to bear in mind that this document was prior to the Korean War. It was in April 1950, before it was not a response to the Korean War. It preceded it. NSC 68 called for a huge increase in the military system. The actual figures behind it were maybe tripling or more of the military system. It called for a rollback strategy against the Soviet Union, a policy designed to break the Soviet Union up and to take it over. The wording was something, it was the following, I'm quoting it now. The policy was designed to foster the seeds of destruction within the Soviet system by a variety of means, which would enable the United States, quote, to negotiate a settlement with the Soviet Union or a successor state or states. Now, this policy of breaking up the Soviet Union required, they said, sacrifice and discipline in the United States. It required cutback, huge military expenditures, cutback of social measures. It required that we take measures to overcome what they called the excess of tolerance or domestic dissent. In other words, you got to control the citizens and, you know, impose totalitarian discipline and, in general, prevent the threat of democratic politics. That's the hardline extreme. It's only what kind of means were they talking about? Well, the means were, in fact, being used. They weren't just being talked about. They were being used, in fact, prior to this. They were using, for example, such means as U.S. support for armies fighting inside the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe, armies that had been established and encouraged by Hitler, which were now being supported with CIA agents and airdrops and so on. This was considered, and also it involved things like turning over West German intelligence to a network run by Reinhard Gehlen, who was in charge of Nazi military intelligence in the Eastern Front. So reconstitute the Nazi network for the Eastern Front, and so on. These were the measures that were already in place prior to NSC 68. All of this is known in the United States, but considered insignificant. We might react a little bit differently, let's say, if we found that the Soviet Union in 1950 was supporting armies in the Rockies established by Hitler and dropping agents and supplies to them. But we consider it our right, since we own the world, we consider it our right to do anything anywhere, whereas others plainly don't have equivalent rights. So that's the hardline extreme, and notice that the policies were being implemented. Well, let's turn to the doves. Let's turn to the other extreme. The leading dovish figure was undoubtedly George Kennan. He headed the State Department planning staff until 1950, at which time he was replaced by Paul Nitze. That was a switch from the dovish to the hawkish extreme of the spectrum. Kennan was one of the major figures in shaping the post-war world. He's also one of the most humane and intelligent and also lucid of state planners. And therefore, what he wrote is extremely interesting to illustrate the dovish extreme. I've sampled the hawkish extreme. For example, one document which you ought to look at if you want to understand your country is PPS 23, Policy Planning Study 23, published by the State Department planning staff, written by George Kennan, top secret, of course, February 1948. Here's what it says. I'll now quote it. We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming, and our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. We need not deceive ourselves that we can afford today the luxury of altruism and world benefaction. We should cease to talk about vague and unreal objectives, such as human rights, the raising of the living standards, and democratization. The day is not far off when we're going to have to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are then hampered by idealistic slogans, the better. Now, that, of course, is a top secret document. To pacify the public, it's necessary to trumpet the idealistic slogans, as is done constantly. But here, planners are talking to one another. Now, these prescriptions, in fact, referred to the Far East, but the United States is a global power, and the same principles apply elsewhere. as Kennan and others explained. So, for example, in a briefing for Latin American ambassadors in 1950, Kennan observed that a major concern of U.S. foreign policy must be, I'm quoting, the protection of our raw materials. Notice, our raw materials. Again, this is secret, so you can be open about it. To protect our resources, we have to combat a dangerous heresy which had been detected by U.S. intelligence shortly before, and which they said was spreading through Latin America, namely, quote, the wide acceptance of the idea that the government has direct responsibility for the welfare of the people. That's what's called communism. Whatever the political commitments of the advocates, they can be church-based self-help groups or whatever, but they're communists if they fall under this heresy. Again, another term of newspeak. I should say, incidentally, that on documents that are meant just for internal use, all of this is made pretty clear. So, for example, there's a high-level study in 1955, run out of Harvard and the Woodrow Wilson Foundation and the National Planning Association and so on, edited by William Yandel Elliott, one of the big honchos in the field at the time. And this study called The Political Economy of American Foreign Policy goes into these topics, and they actually define communism and its operative usage. They say that the threat of the communist powers, the essential threat of the communist powers, is that they refuse to allow their economies to complement the industrial economies of the West. Translating it into plain English, they do not understand that their function is to serve us. And in fact, that's a good operational definition of communist as it's actually used. Doesn't matter where they come from. If they do that, meaning falling under the heresy that intelligence noted, they're communists. Well, Kennan went on to explain the means that we have to use against our enemies who fall prey to this heresy that threatens our resources, which happen to be in their countries. Quote, the final answer might be an unpleasant one, but we should not hesitate before police repression by the local government. This is not shameful, since the communists are essentially traitors. It's better to have a strong regime in power than a liberal government if it is indulgent and relaxed and penetrated by communists. Again, the term communist being used in the technical sense. Well, all of this is, remember, I'm sampling the dovish side of the spectrum here. All of this is totally excluded from and virtually excluded from the scholarly literature, and there's a rich scholarly literature on this, including on Kennan, and it typically claims, in fact, universally claims, that Kennan had no general geopolitical conceptions, just a kind of a vague kind of moral concern. The people who say that, like John Lewis Gaddis, know perfectly well that these documents exist. In fact, in this case, I happen to be quoting from a collection of documents edited by Gaddis, who wrote the standard scholarly work on Kennan, so he knows it exists, but obviously you can't tell people that. Well, these views illustrate the spectrum of opinion among planners, and the documentary record pretty well falls within that spectrum, as you can discover by checking it. Occasionally, you can find some qualifications. So, for example, there's an influential study of April 1947, secret again, which observed that, about aid, it observed that foreign aid should be restricted to countries of, I'm quoting now, countries of primary strategic importance to the United States, excepting in those rare instances which present an opportunity for the United States to gain worldwide approbation by an act strikingly humanitarian. Now, this stance, again, is not unique to the United States, and it did not arise in the post-war period. So let's return to Woodrow Wilson, who, as you know, was the great apostle of self-determination, and who celebrated this doctrine by invading Mexico and invading Haiti and the Dominican Republic, where his warriors murdered and destroyed, reestablished virtual slavery, demolished the political system, while establishing the basis for murderous and corrupt dictatorships and placed the area firmly into the hands of U.S. investors. Again, all of this pretty much suppressed in even the scholarly literature, but certainly the general literature. Haiti was in the news recently, and much talk Although, if you looked back, there was much talk about traditional U.S. benevolence towards Haiti, nothing about the truth, which is, as I have just briefly described it. Woodrow Wilson, his Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, once wrote a memorandum explaining the meaning of the Monroe Doctrine. Wilson decided that it would be, in his words, impolitic to issue the memorandum, but he found its argument unanswerable. That was his word, very impressed by it. Here's what it said. In its advocacy of the Monroe Doctrine, the United States considers its own interests. The integrity of other American nations is an incident, not an end. While this may seem based on selfishness alone, the author of the doctrine had no higher or more generous motive in its declaration. The task at hand at that time, the document went on, was European interference in the American continent through financial and other means, which had to be opposed, and Wilson's practice, in fact, opposed it, for example, by including Britain, which was the evil empire of the day, excluding them from Central American oil concessions. The major change after World War II is that the United States was able to apply these principles on a global scale, given its power, and of course the evil empire from which it had to defend itself was no longer the Huns or the British. Well, Kennan's nutshell presentation of U.S. foreign policy did not emerge from a vacuum. It reflected a much broader geopolitical analysis that had been developed by elite groups and planning studies through the war. There were study groups of the State Department, including virtually all their top planners, and the Council on Foreign Relations, which provides the main business input into foreign policy planning, through the war, 1939 to 1945. And they formulated kind of a theory of what the post-war world should look like. They formulated the concept of what they called the grand area, a region which they said should be subordinated to the needs of the American economy. It should include the Western Hemisphere, the Far East, the former British Empire, which was being dismantled and subordinated to the United States. It was to be extended to a total global system, if possible, surely including Western Europe and the incomparable energy resources of the Middle East, which were then passing into American hands as we pushed out our rivals, France and England. Now, these guiding geopolitical conceptions explain a good deal of what has been happening in the world. If they're not understood, what takes place will appear to be a series of random errors, inconsistencies, confusions, traceable to the failings of a political leadership that is in fact succeeding quite brilliantly in its assigned chores. The Third World was to be incorporated within the grand area, so was Europe. Europe posed problems, but Soviet aggression was considered a very remote eventuality. The CIA concluded in 1947 that the problem of Europe was not Soviet aggression, which no intelligence expected, but rather the possibility of economic collapse in Western Europe and the consequent accession to power of communist elements. It's one reason for the Marshall Plan, which was also motivated by the needs of U.S. industry for export markets and overseas investment. That came out of Kennan's office, incidentally. Kennan's advice was also followed with regard to Japan. That was the so-called reverse course, which took place in 1947. It terminated the early steps towards democratization in Japan, which were taken by General MacArthur's military administration. The reverse course suppressed the unions and other democratic forces and placed the country firmly in the hands of corporate elements that had backed Japanese fascism, a system of state and private power that still endures. There's no time to go into it, but the background for planning for the Vietnam War takes place in that context. It takes place in the context of ensuring that the grand area will include Southeast Asia, accommodating itself to Japan. Kennan's planning staff, again, we're talking about the Doves, explained that Southeast Asia must fulfill its major function as a source of raw materials and a market for Japan and Western Europe. They got to understand that that's their function. Vietnamese nationalists didn't understand it. They had to therefore be smashed. The threat was not that they were going to conquer anyone, but that there might be a dangerous demonstration effect of national independence, which might spread throughout the region, same threat that arises in Nicaragua and elsewhere repeatedly. Incidentally, I should mention, though this is a very interesting story, and if you want, I'll go into it later, but let me just note that the United States, contrary to what everyone says, left and right, contrary to what virtually everyone says, the United States achieved its major objectives in Indochina. That was a partial victory for the United States. No successes in Indochina will infect the region. The kind of economic and social development that American planners were very much afraid of in the late 1950s and early 60s, particularly in South Vietnam, and remember, South Vietnam was the main target of the American attack throughout, and the United States won its war against South Vietnam. It's demolished. No successes there will infect the region. In fact, these countries will be lucky to survive. And post-1975 U.S. policy has, in fact, been designed to maximize repression and suffering in the countries that were devastated by U.S. violence. Meanwhile, the United States, the degree of the cruelty of this is quite astonishing if you look at the details. For example, when the Mennonites tried to send pencils to Cambodia, the State Department stopped them. When Oxfam tried to send 10 solar pumps, government stopped them. When religious groups tried to send shovels to Laos to try to dig up some of the unexploded ordnance left by the American bombing, the government tried to stop them. When India tried to send 100 buffalo to Vietnam to replace the huge buffalo herds that were destroyed by the American attack, and remember, this is a primitive country. Buffaloes means fertilizer, tractors, and so on. The United States threatened to cancel food for peace aid. That's one that Orwell would have appreciated. If India sent 100 buffalo to Vietnam, and so on. Meanwhile, while the United States was extirpating the cancer at its source, the threat of successful development in South Vietnam and elsewhere at its source, it buttressed what was called the second line of defense, for example, by supporting the Suharto takeover in Indonesia, with some 500,000 killed in a few months in 1965, backing the overthrow of Philippine democracy in 1972, supporting martial law in South Korea, again in 1972, again under Carter in 1980, and so on.
You're listening to a speech by Professor Noam Chomsky given in 1986. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Idaho, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, California, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. We return to the conclusion of Chomsky's speech.
Well, in accordance with the reigning geopolitical conceptions, right at the end of World War II, the United States turned at once to dealing with the problem faced, with a major problem faced by the population of the world, which had been politicized by the war, namely the problem faced by the anti-fascist resistance. The anti-fascist resistance in the liberated regions had to be suppressed, and the United States turned to that task globally, often suppressing it in favor of Nazi and fascist collaborators. This, in fact, is a major theme of early post-war history, which is barely discussed. It ought to be chapter one in an honest history of the post-war period, but you really have to look into the technical monographs to find it. What was the problem? Well, the primary concern is one that had been formulated by one of Winston Churchill's closest advisors, Jan Christian Smuts, a South African prime minister. He pointed out to Churchill in 1943 that with politics let loose among those peoples, we may have a wave of disorder and wholesale communism set going all over those parts of Europe. Communism, again, in the technical sense.